Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, everyone loves a good story, but have you ever stopped and wondered why? My next guest argues that there's something evolutionary about narrative and fiction. It may be part of what sets us apart from other animals. Joining me now is Jonathan Gottschall, professor of English at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania, and now the author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Professor Gottschall is also one of the leading figures in literary Darwinism, a growing field of scholarship which applies evolutionary principles to literature. Welcome to WNYC.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And you point out that evolution is ruthlessly utilitarian. So what purpose does fiction and storytelling serve?
Well, let's step back a little bit and see if we can make this problem pop in our minds a little bit. If you do a quick thought experiment, if you imagine there's two you throw your minds back into the mists of prehistory and imagine there's two tribes living in some isolated African valley. One tribe is called the story people. One tribe is called the practical people. The two tribes are alike in every way except the ways indicated by their name. So they both hunt, they both gather, they both woo, they both raise their children. But at the end of the day, the story people go back to their village. They throng around the hearth fire and they make up wild lies about tricksters and heroes and the gods, and they trade them back and forth. And while they're doing that, the practical people are in the other valley, and they are just working. They're working more. They're hunting more. They're gathering more. They're wooing more. They're not wasting their time on storytelling. And so the question is, if you didn't know at the outset that the story people were the ones that inherited the earth, wouldn't you expect that the practical people would outcompete those frivolous story people? And the fact that they didn't is the evolutionary riddle of fiction.
You've taken a scientific approach to this, as we said, citing studies and neuroscience throughout the book. So do you come to conclude that there is a storytelling part of the brain?
Yeah. The neuroscience isn't that fine-grained yet, but there's a sort of undeniable hunger for story. People live in stories. The big premise of the book is that people are storytelling animals. We read novels, we watch films, we listen to songs that are usually story-based. Our children make believe, they pretend. And when we're not consuming stories made up by other people, we're making up our own. When we dream, we dream in stories. When we wake up, we daydream about half of our waking hours. And these can be very vivid fantasies. These little stories we scream in our minds where all of our, you know, vain, dirty wishes come true. So there's a lot of argument about what most makes us human. Is it our intelligence? That's the argument when we call our species Homo sapiens. But other people say, no, it's upright posture. We're Homo erectus. Other people say, we're Homo habilis. It's tool use that makes us special, or it's language, or it's culture. The argument of the book is that all those things are important, but one factor is left out of storytelling, the way we live in fiction.
You write about mirror neurons. What are they and what do they do that's relevant to how we appreciate a good story?
Well, this was a neat area of research. There's until recently, there's been sort of two models of story consumption. One is that you kind of sit back passively and the story washes over you and nothing much changes. You have a nice escapist experience. The other theory is that fiction changes us, that it modifies us. And so there's now lab studies that show that when you listen to a story, your body and your mind, your brain, are reacting to it much like they would react to real life things. So when the hero kisses the heroine in the film, our minds are lighting up much like, you know, if we were doing the kissing.
So what does it mean when someone isn't empathetic or lack social skills? Are their mirror neurons not working and do they not enjoy fiction as much?
I changed that around a little bit. There's some very cool studies that have started to delve into what are the psychological ramifications of the fact that we spend so much of our lives marinating our brains in fiction. And so there's a team of psychologists at the University of Toronto who've sort of pioneered this research. And they've showed that people who read a lot of fiction or watch a lot of fiction tend to have better social skills and greater empathy than people who read and watch a lot of nonfiction. And they're able to control for the arrow of causation. It's not just that people who already had good social skills are more attracted to story. It's something about story being involved in those intense simulations of social life that seems to make us better at navigating real-life social dilemmas.
My guest on WNYC is Jonathan Gottschall, author of the book The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. He is one of the leading figures in what's known as literary Darwinism, described as a last best hope for the humanities, as literary criticism in general is going through such an existential crisis. Is this a new way of studying the human condition?
I think it is. There's been sort of artificial barriers thrown up between the humanities and sciences that have been, in the words of C.P. Snow, sheer loss to us all. The sciences have basically respected the barrier. They haven't trespassed into any of humanities territory. And the humanities haven't taken advantage of any of the tools of the sciences, for instance, the scientific method. Yeah, there's an opportunity by combining these two modes of thinking to come up with newer, better, more durable knowledge about humanities subjects.
So as an example, perhaps there's the content of the stories like when the plot of, you know, like the plot of Pride and Prejudice or the Iliad and what they tell us about human nature and our evolutionary needs.
Yeah.
These are examples, if you analyze in that way, of literary Darwinism?
Yeah, I'd say so. The main thing to understand about literary Darwinism, I think, is it's an addition to what we're doing already, not a subtraction. It's not about sort of steamrolling all other ways of looking at literature and saying, no, this is the right way to do it. You have to look at it in terms of survival and reproduction. But you do see things in literature that aren't seen otherwise except through the evolutionary lens. So one of the things you find in storytelling generally, again, across cultures, across centuries, is that their stories are just like ours and they're fixated on exactly the same things, themes of survival and reproduction, sex and death, which are the great evolutionary themes as well.
Ironically, it sounds like a way of making literature pragmatic, and you are juxtaposing, you know, the practical tribe and the storytelling tribe, but we don't seem so interested in academia anymore in analyzing literature. That's the existential crisis. Those kind of humanities classes are, you know, to some degree threatened right now and being cut left and right. But by looking at them in this scientific or evolutionary way, you're making a utilitarian argument for it.
Yeah, to some extent. And I think one of the reasons literature programs are under duress is that we have isolated ourselves from the progress of science. We've kind of built a wall up around ourselves. And as a result, the knowledge we've produced hasn't been very high quality over the last several decades.
It's like saying that, we should teach all kids music because it makes them good in math. That's not the reason to teach all kids music.
Right, right.
I want to play a clip of the infamous, somewhat discredited, but still a hero to many, Mike Daisy, because you're describing this human draw we have to narrative. And it brings to mind the Mike Daisy controversy over his play in general about Apple working conditions,
right,
and his piece for This American Life about those factories in China where Apple products and other devices are made. Now, This American Life retracted Daisy's story because many parts of the story were fictional. I want to play about a minute from the follow-up by Rob Schmitz of Marketplace. Here is a stretch from Mike Daisy's original piece, and then his translator, Kathy, reacts.
When he says this, I reach into my satchel and I take out my iPad. And when he sees it, his eyes widen because one of the ultimate ironies of globalism, at this point, there are no iPads in China. He's never actually seen one on this thing that took his hand. I turn it on unlock the screen, and pass it to him. He takes it. The icons flare into view, and he strokes the screen with his ruined hand. And the icons slide back and forth. And he says something to Kathy. And Kathy says, he says, it's a kind of magic.
No, this is not true. It's, you know, it's just like a movie scenery.
So my question for you is there a scientific explanation for the kind of narrative that Daisy constructed, or a science to why it fooled so many people?
This comes up all the time. Every month or two, it seems like we have a new memoir scandal or the Mike Daisy sort of scandal. Well, there's, you know, we all have a tendency to want to tell a better story. It's how we rivet each other's attention. It's how we gain status. What's interesting to me about it, from a scientific point of view, is our reaction to it. We're outraged that we've been lied to. We brand this guy a scoundrel. And my reaction to it is that, well, yeah, he shouldn't have lied, but people in glass houses, you know, shouldn't throw stones. We're all telling these kinds of stories. We all have a sort of life story about who we are, how we got this way. And those stories are really more truthy than true. The memories on which they're based are substantially fictionalized. They're distorted. And we have a sort of wildly optimistic sense of our own personal quality. So we can, you can kind of think of our own life stories as sort of a novel in process. It's always being edited and embellished and rewritten by an unreliable narrator.
And I wonder if there's a dangerous element of narrative in public life. There's something appealing about the candidate with a good story, which is why there's so much of an effort in campaigns to craft a good narrative. And to a certain extent, that's been a handicap for Governor Romney, for example, that the public can't relate to him very well in this GOP race, and it's not good enough for him to state policy positions that people may or may not disagree with. So as someone who's thought a lot about the role storytelling plays, do you have any reflections on it in government and politics?
Well, first off, I agree with you. We can't relate to Romney's story. We don't like him as a character. He'd be the rich guy, the rich antagonist in the film. But yeah, I think there's a sense in which a political campaign can be seen not only as a debate between two charismatic politicians and their ideas, but as a story contest, as a contest between two rival narratives about the country's past, present, and where we want it to go.
Here's a question from a listener posting on our website who writes, as an aspiring children's author, I'd be interested in his understanding of why the predominant storytelling formula is so ubiquitous. We meet the protagonist. The protagonist has a problem or a pursuit in the quest to resolve it. The problem worsens or new problems emerge, including an antagonist. The antagonist has a fatal flaw. The protagonist takes advantage of it, achieves the goal, and the ending is happy.
Absolutely. I think it's a wonderful question, and it's one of the things that I'm most interested in. The idea that stories are about trouble, they're about problems, they're about conflict is so familiar, it's almost a cliche, but it's still shocking. There's all kinds of different ways that stories could be told. Stories could be about pure wish fulfillment, where everything is fine and dandy and nothing bad ever happens. You might even expect that, but it's not. Stories structured on problems, and so are children's stories, and so are the stories that children make up themselves, and so are the stories in dreams. And so some people say that maybe from the form of fiction, you can jump to a thesis about the function of fiction. And so this is this has been called the sort of the flight simulator theory of fiction, that in the same way that a pilot goes into a flight simulator and trains up on the problems of flying, we go into fiction, experience these simulated problems, and get better at it without the danger of going down in flames like you might if you did it in real life.
But let's finish up on the question of children's stories, because you write in the book about stories that young children tend to make up. And they're pretty gruesome.
There
are disappearing parents and stabbings and lost kids. And when you look at the canon of young adult fiction these days, similar themes show up a lot. Orphans, real danger, very dark storylines. Yep. This is controversial among parents. How does neuroscience explain the tendency for children themselves to invent such dark stories?
Well, yeah, this is something
whether or not they've had dark lives seems to be the case.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah, and you find it cross-culturally, too. It's not just us. You find it in the suburbs. You find it in the slums of India. You find it in African villages. Children's stories are about trouble. Stories generally are about trouble. So developmental psychologists have done a lot of work on this. They've been studying this for decades. And the general consensus, this is one element of storytelling that's not very controversial, what its evolutionary purpose is. For the most part, most developmental psychologists will tell you that play, pretend play for children, just as it is for other animals, not pretend play, but play in other animals, is a form of rehearsal for adult life. They're engaging, they're training, they're building social and emotional intelligence so that they'll be more competent as adults.
Jonathan Gottschall, professor of English at Washington and Jefferson College in Pennsylvania, and now the author of The Storytelling Animal, How Stories Make Us Human. Fascinating. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Next storytelling protagonist, Mike Wallace, as we will look at the episode from his career that is being remembered as his professional low point, but maybe unfairly. Stay with us.